don't take the easy road out and because it's comfortable. Go after challenge. Take the hard work.
Hello and welcome to A Pixie from Kilmarnock, a program about the people, places, and the history of the Northern Neck. I'm your host, Pixie E. Curry. Separate but equal. The doctrine that racial segregation is constitutional as long as the facilities provided for blacks and whites are roughly equal. Roughly equal. For early black education, that meant hand-me-down books, watered-down curriculum, no physics, foreign languages, advanced mathematics, adequate facilities or resources to teach fertile black minds. Despite the unequal education playing field, black children had one mighty arsenal in their corner, the dedication of parents and teachers who were determined that their children received the best education that they could provide them. It was a case of not accepting what situation you were presently in, but where were you going in your future and how prepared you were for that future. Al Stewart was a prepared young man. I interview Al in May of 2021 and again in February of 2022. We had survived a turbulent time in our history when the political slant of our world was trying to turn back the hands of time. Racial tension was prominent. Black people were experiencing the hatred and divide that their ancestors had endured and what their parents thought they had kept at bay. In the midst of this, Al had earned the top positions in all of his endeavors, the military, education, and his career. He never lost his sense of humor, his dedication to be his best, or the fire that lit his desire to be a winner. It is with great pride, admiration, and love that I present to you Mr. Al Stewart, graduate of Northumberland High School, class of 1973, former Acting Secretary of Labor for the United States of America.
My name is Milton Al Stewart. I was born in February of 1955, so therefore I'm 66 years old at this particular moment. I grew up in Callao, Virginia, which is in the Northern Neck area of Virginia, which is like the Third Peninsula, at the tip of the Third Peninsula. I went to college at Virginia State College, which was the name at the college that I went to at the time, back in 1973 after I graduated. I was in the ROTC program, Army ROTC program at that particular time. I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the first part of June of 1977, and into the regular army, as a matter of fact. So I had a regular army commission, became a field artillery officer. I had already been to airborne school, and after I went to field artillery officer training, I went to ranger school down in Fort Benning, Georgia, and I was awarded the ranger tap, after which I was assigned to the 2nd Infantry Division in South Korea for 1 year, after which I came back to the United States, and I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division for about 3 years, and I got out of the Army. I decided to go back to graduate school in about May or June of 2081 because I had to make sure that I stayed in the military for 4 years, which is what I did in accordance with my commission. After which I came to Washington, D.C. I worked at the District of Columbia Department of Public Works for a number of years and doing, well, for, before even before that, after I graduated from graduate school in North Carolina, came to the District of Columbia, worked in the D.C. Department of Public Works, worked there for several years. I had been in the reserves while I was in North Carolina going to graduate school at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro campus. Then when I got here to D.C., started work for the D.C. Department of Public Works, and I was still in the reserves for a little bit, and then I transferred over to the D.C. Department of National Guard, and I was awarded the opportunity to be a company commander in the D.C. National Guard, and I held onto that for about a year or two. And eventually, I applied for a position within the federal government at the U.S. Department of Labor, and that was back in 1991, and they accepted me. I was a GS-13 at the time. And, you know, I was promoted through the ranks eventually. I got a promotion to GS-14, 15, and then eventually I became a senior executive within the department. And I was the director of the Business Operations Center for a number of years. And when I say a number of years, I'm talking about like maybe close to 18 years. Since then, I've been through, let's see, six presidents and nine secretaries of labor at the U.S. Department of Labor. So I've been there close to 30 years. And currently I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Operations within an agency within the Department of Labor called the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Administration and Management. And basically I handle things including IT, information technology, human resources, security, emergency management, the Civil Rights Center, all things dealing with OHR, which is basically human resources, and a host of other matters that I'm responsible for. OSAM, as we call it, is responsible for over 1,000 federal employees and over 2,000 contract employees. So that's why I'm here. That's what I'm doing at this particular time. And after the recent election in 2020, in January of 2021, I was designated by President Biden as the acting secretary of the Department of Labor until his nominee could be approved by the U.S. Senate. And I've been acting secretary from January 20th until March 23rd, which is about 62 days, which customarily happens, not just at Department of Labor, but all federal agencies. And now I'm back in my regular job. But at the time, I was doing my regular job plus acting secretary, so I had to approve several things that normally the secretary would be approving.
I'm just going to sit here and absorb all that. I'm just thinking about that routine that used to be on in Living Color. Is they call you a little butterbean? Don't you have some time to go ahead and get another job? Can you please go ahead and pick up some peanut shells off the floor? That's fine. That's 5 cents an hour.
That's sweet of you.
I love you too. For a lot of people growing up, the military was our way of getting out because there weren't any kind of, you know, someone telling you how you could apply for grants so you could go to college, or your parents didn't have enough money to fund you. You know, the counselors, you know, they kind of divided, you know, the students who was going to go to college and who wasn't. That was not our choice, but their choice. So, you being able to, go into the ROTC once you got to college, and you made such a wonderful, wonderful life for yourself because of it, is admirable.
Yeah, I thank you very much. But it came out as a result of coming from a family of nine kids, and I was the ninth one, and the community that we had in place. And you know what? When I was growing up, I didn't experience prejudice on a daily basis. Maybe I didn't recognize it because it was so subtle and I had just gotten numb and used to it. But I never had people refer to me as using the N-word or colored or something like that. And I can remember this so dramatically. and that is during the situation, during the 60s, when I was a youngster, maybe less than 10 years old, maybe 12 years old or so, when I was still at Lossberg Elementary School, I can remember going into my mother's and father's bedroom. And after the decision about integration came out with regard to places where, the integration, the Supreme Court ruling, but when Virginia decided to integrate, I can remember that was being announced on the news, and I came into my parents' bedroom, and I said, because I didn't know how proms operated, you know, when you go to the prom, I said, does this mean I'm going to have to go to school with a white girl? I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know, maybe it's because the conversations that were floating around the house, I thought it was like, okay, now you're required to go to school. You're required to take a white girl to the prom. Because I didn't know what the prom was about. And because people were talking about things about the prom. So I'd heard certain things, but it was like, okay, now you're mandated to take a white girl to the prom. I didn't know what that meant. It was like, I didn't know you had a choice because of this ruling. But that's how it impacts kids that are underage and don't know what's going on. But yeah, I remember asking that question. I can remember walking in and asking my mother and father that. And they say, you don't worry about that. You know, you can do what you want to do, et cetera, et cetera. But they didn't come down on me and say, white people are bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I probably heard doing just hanging out around the house with my parents and my sisters and brothers, comments being made about the fact that, wow, you know, what we're going to do now? You know, how is this going to work out, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, but my parents never suffered any, you know, crosses in the front yard and all that kind of stuff like they do, that you people experience down in Alabama and South Carolina and Georgia and stuff like that. We never experienced any of that. Yeah. But I'm sure that there were subtle ways that people were, you know, told what place they need to be put in. I mean, my mother used to clean houses for white people. You know, she did that for a number of years. Hell yeah. Yeah. That's where I grew up in.
Let's see, one of the degrees I know that you have a judicial degree.
Yeah, and I didn't mention that along the way, but once I got out of the Army in 1981, I went to graduate school at the University of North Carolina Greensboro campus and for a master's in history. And then while I was there, I applied for law school at North Carolina Central University, and I got accepted. And so immediately after I finished my master's degree, I think it was like a year and a half or so, I enrolled into North Carolina Central University's School of Law and got my JD. And so I graduated from there in, I guess, May or June probably of 1985. And then that's when I came to Washington, D.C. So there was a little gap that I didn't previously explain. After becoming, when I was the director of the Business Operations Center, I think that I mentioned previously, one of the things that I didn't realize until after I had received it, but senior DOL leadership back in 2007, 2008 timeframe, they have a program called the Presidential Rank Award Program. And basically what they do is they nominate people to the White House who can receive a particular award. There are two awards. One is the Presidential Rank Award for Meritorious Service, and there's a rank award, senior executives, for Distinguished Service. Back in 2008, I received the Presidential Rank Award for Meritorious Service, and that comes with a 20% award based upon your salary. So if your salary is $100,000, that means the award is something is going to be 20% of that. That's on top of normally what senior executives receive as a bonus. I received that back in 2008, and I'm told that I've been nominated for a distinguished award recently for last year's performance.
No doubt. Let me take you back to being on the Northern Neck. What was your first job?
Oh, my first job was picking tomatoes when I was about 13 years old for 25 cents a basket. That was my first job during the summer. And I think my parents did that to convince me to go to college because I had that job for several summers. 25 cents a basket. And I remember guy's name, but I remember him whose farm I worked on to do that. And it was from sunup to sundown. And a lot of my relatives were in the field with me when I was doing that. I'm 13, and there were relatives in the field with me that were 35, 40 years old. And I'm going like, wait a minute, you guys are here doing this? This is your lifestyle? This is what you have to look forward to forever? And that's backbreaking work. 25 cents a basket, picking tomatoes. Going through the field, morning glory in certain places. Morning glory is a plant.
Oh, I know.
Well, I used to pick tomatoes for 25 cents a basket. I mean, pickup truck come through the yard. Hey, get on the truck. And my parents said, yeah, go on, do that. So I did that, and then I elevated myself eventually to working at the sawmill in Callao, Virginia. Earl Stevens, I forget the name of the Stevens sawmill. But I started working at the sawmill, you know, doing lumber and all that kind of stuff. And I did that when I was in high school a little bit. And then I went away to college, and during the summers I'd come back home. I had to work there during the summer. Yeah. Until I graduated from college at Virginia State College, which now is Virginia State University. Yeah. I had to do that. And so I tell my son now, I say, you don't know what hard work is. You don't know what hard work is. You do not know what hard work is until you've been in that particular type of situation. And, I remember that. 25 cents a basket. And some people were picking 100 baskets a day. I wasn't doing that. But some people could do that because that's their life. They had to do that from sun up, sun down, all of their lives. No Social Security. The farmer didn't pay you any Social Security benefit. He just paid you how many baskets you picked. You had no rights back then. It wasn't until I went to the sawmill that I saw people actually getting paychecks where they're, you know, you get Social Security taken out and all that kind of stuff. Well, picking tomatoes, or cleaning somebody's house? No. Somebody didn't. Yeah. Eventually she got Social Security, but it was a minuscule amount.
I can remember my parents asking us, you know, when they had that free choice coming out of 7th grade when I went to Auntie Jean's. And we could either go to then Central or to Northumberland High School.
Mm-hmm.
And
You had a choice.
Yeah, free choice. That's what it was called, free choice. How did you feel when those choices were made?
I mean, I went along with them because I had been probably not necessarily indoctrinated, but just comfortable about what the experience that I had lived with around town. My parents were very protective of me. And so it's not much that I could do outside the permission of my parents as far as going outside until, you know, I could get up and drive on my own and all that kind of stuff. And then you kind of knew the community rules as far as dating white women and all that kind of stuff, or vice versa. And so, you know, because what you watch on TV a lot of times with regard to the civil rights movement sort of made you understand where your position was. You were kind of less than a white person at that particular time. And so you kind of knew when you walked out into the community back in the 1960s, if you had a TV to watch, you knew what your position was. You could expect what's going to happen. And so it was sort of like, it's not a surprise how you're going to be received in the community as a whole or in schools that you attend, and that you're likely to be treated differently. And that's when I say you were probably numb to it, because that's just the way it was. That's what you expected. Not that you didn't like it, but that's just the way it was. And now we've gotten to the point after the civil rights movement that I'm not accepting that crap anymore. I'm just not accepting. I don't care what you do, what you tell me, you think what rights you have and all this kind of stuff. And what has happened is the fact that now the population trend is changing such that there are more minorities in the United States than there are whites. They don't like that. So what do? They do redistricting, and such that they can have control over their voting populations. And when that doesn't work, they're doing exactly what is occurring now that you read in the news reports, and they're changing the voting rights state laws to restrict voting in various jurisdictions, so minorities don't have as much power to vote as white. You can't even get water. In a certain place, you can't even get water to people in mouth. What the hell?
Have you ever heard of anything?
That don't make no goddamn sense.
Not at all. Not at all.
Why do you care about that?
I can't.
Why do you care about that? I can understand if you're giving somebody, if I can understand it being a law against giving somebody poison while they're standing in line, but water? Come on now.
or setting up a barbecue.
Yeah, or shooting people while they're in line. I can understand a law against that.
Well, you know.
But you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. The absurdity of it all. Yep, it's just absurd. Who motivated you as you was growing up, and who was your favorite teacher, or who were your favorite teachers?
Well, there's a lot of people who motivated me, particularly my mom and my father and my aunts and uncles and my sisters, because in my family of nine, there were five boys and four girls. Pretty much all of the girls went to college. None of the boys, with the exception of me, I went to college. They didn't go to college. And I'm the only one of the entire family who went into the military. So I was really encouraged by a lot of my sisters and my parents. They you need to go to college. So I was motivated by that. As far as teachers are concerned, I do remember certain teachers that come to mind. Mrs. Roan in the first grade, who was from my community. Mrs. Washington, you remember Veronica Washington?
Mm-hmm.
Her mother was a teacher. I remember her, and I remember a Mrs. Turner. In the third or fourth grade, somewhere around there. And I do remember a Mr. Giddings, who was very, very instrumental. And then I had certain teachers that were, when we integrated into North Dunlin High, there were certain teachers. There was one teacher, I forget his name, but he went to James Madison University, and he was a history teacher. forget his name. Of course, then there's one of my most important teachers, Deirdre Scrittney, who was very encouraging and wasn't too old, much older than we were at the time, maybe 6 or 7 years older. But she was very encouraging because she came with an enlightened view, and her husband, who's now dead, you know.
Yes.
Jan Scrittney. Mm-hmm. But now, I think she is called Deirdre Callanan. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those were my encouraging folks, and they basically, because they came from outside of the community, and they basically said, you know, we understand what you guys. He didn't say it openly, but it was implied, you know, you guys deserve as much as the white students here.
Yes. So. I think it was the first time that the white kids ever learned anything about the black culture was because of the Scrittneys, of Deirdre Scrittney and Jan Scrittney. It was wonderful. I mean, just loved them to the till my dying day.
Mm-hmm.
What's some of the favorite foods of the Northern Neck that you just hanker for?
Fried chicken, turnip greens, mashed potatoes.
Now, you can get that anywhere. We're talking Northern Neck here now.
Oysters. I love oysters. I love oysters and seafood, but particularly oysters. Yeah. Because it's a seafood community.
So, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll give you the collard greens, because what advice do you have?
Go to school. Get your degree. Get your college degree and prepare yourself for getting your college degree. Because, and here's what it is. People need to understand, you need to do what other societies do to prepare to get your degree. First of all, you need to, for the various tests that you have to take to get into college, don't wait to just take the test and say, okay, I went to high school, I'm going to take the test. Go take preparatory courses to take the test. Prep to take the test. Go, and there are courses online that you can prepare yourself to take these college tests so you can get into Harvard and places like that. Also, challenge yourself. Play sports. Play a lot of sports, because all of that stuff goes on your resume when these colleges and universities look at your resume. Be involved in student government politics. Get involved. Campaign for yourself. Get into these particular positions, because that's how you get into college and into good colleges. Okay? So promote yourself, and drive yourself and challenge yourself. Don't take the easy road out. For example, before I became an executive in the Department of Labor, people asked me, well, how did you get to become an executive? Well, first of all, I wanted to take on hard jobs. I volunteered for hard jobs. I said, you don't have to give me any extra pay. I want that job right there. I want to do this on a temporary basis. And they go like, oh, shit, he wants to do this on a temporary basis? It's like, I volunteered to be the regional administrator for New York and Boston, just temporarily. I want the experience. Take on the hard jobs. Take on the challenges. Don't take easy shit. Okay? So once you do that, people say, this person actually wants to do some work and wants to accomplish some things. Then they go like, I think we need to promote this person. He goes after the challenges. He doesn't back away from challenges. He runs after challenges. That's the type of person I want. That's the type of person I want to lead this organization. So don't take the easy road out, and because it's comfortable. Even if it's the federal government and your income is guaranteed, go after challenges.
take the hard work. I volunteer for the hard work. Don't volunteer for the easy work. Anybody can do that. That's why, you know, anybody can do that. Go after challenge. Go beyond what you think you can do, and you'll be surprised what you can do.
Well, little Butterbean, I'm going to let you go ahead and do another job.
Yeah.
Get you ready. Al, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your very, very busy schedule. And I also want to say how proud I am that you have achieved what you have achieved. You epitomize a person that did not let anything stand in his way. And you achieved a great, great, great success. Again, I want to thank you for taking the time, and hopefully you will let me talk to you again.
Oh, yes. I would love to talk to you again. All right. Love you.
Love you too, Al.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You are listening to A Pixie from Kilmarnock with an interview with Al Stewart, former Acting Secretary of Labor for the United States of America, presently Deputy Assistant Secretary for Operations for the Department of Labor, and a retired Commissioned Officer of the United States Army. The last time that we talked was May of 2021, and this is February of 2022. Wow. And in that time, so much has happened. So that I could piggyback on the fact that you have a judicial degree, I want to ask a question. And again, you know, times since I last spoke to you, things have changed here in the Commonwealth. One of those things, you know where I'm going here. One of those things, CRT controversy here in Virginia, a mandate that anyone that is caught in violation of the mandate that CRT is banned from being taught in classrooms. And I was wondering that as a teacher, I'm just assuming that, you know, they will come under the umbrella of the Department of Labor if they are being reprimanded. Is that actually legal that they can tell teachers that they cannot teach a particular subject matter, and if you are caught in violation, that you will be reprimanded? Isn't there some type of legality that is being crossing the line here?
Right. As you know, a lot of these states, to include not just Virginia, but Texas and other states, there, the governors of those particular states are taking drastic measures to control basically what students are taught and things of that nature. They have a lot of power and authority until it's tested out in the court somehow. Not only that, but the states control basically what's been taught. State governments have, for a long time, controlled the various textbooks that people can read and cannot read. Texas, and I think maybe Florida, they've come up with a list of various textbooks that can be used and cannot be used, and a lot of it is based upon racial controversial things. So they have a lot of authority, and unless it's considered to be a violation of federal law, which at this particular point, the courts have not ruled on that, they will have sway in doing that. And if the state's legislatures, they are the ones basically that mandate what can be taught and what cannot be taught and things of that nature. It's a controversial thing, and this probably needs to be tested out in the courts.
I was just thinking of those teachers who are resistant to that they are being censored, and that they have actually put into place a tip line, for lack of a better term, that they can be reported. It's such a dictatorial atmosphere that is attached to the censor. Is again, here we are in February 2022. We're having an invasion, and it seems that we're on a path ourselves to have that type of dictatorship.
Right. Well, you know, people. There are certain ways that people can get around some of this, and some of it is maybe you don't enroll your kids in school, you do homeschooling, or you go to a private school. Obviously, that costs money, but some family members do choose to do that. But as long as the states are controlled by the governor, that you're dealing with state law. And unless there is some type of statute on the books or some case law that says, no, the federal government can come in and dictate what states can teach. And right as of this particular point, I don't think there is. Then the state's going to have controls on those things. For example, if you go up maybe in the Northeast, you may have situations, or in Detroit or whatever, where the governor of Michigan does want to teach CRT. So those governors will be okay doing that. But until you get some type of federal law on the books or some type of case law that says the federal government can dictate to the states exactly what can be taught, which is not on the books at this particular time, those governors will be able to do that. And it's the same way with the various states, such as Texas and a host of other states, maybe Florida as well, that basically have enacted all of these voting laws. I mean, you can't even bring water to someone in line. They also have reduced the number of voting precincts in certain areas that are populated with minorities because they want to control the vote. That's being tested out basically in the courts. Also, you see a lot of case law, cases going to the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals dealing with redistricting such that Republicans have more control in certain areas than, so they will basically be able to send more Republicans to Congress as opposed to Democrats. And that those things are still being tested in the courts. And if it goes to the Supreme Court, and right now the Supreme Court is right-leaning, in other words, more Republicans on the court, it's possible that they'll allow those particular states to do what they want to do. So all of that needs to be tested out in court. And I just read an article, too, a newspaper article recently that mentioned that people in the United States, they're finding that people are moving to locations that agree basically with their political philosophy than, you know, in the past. So that means that if you're a Republican, maybe you move to one of the southern states that believes in your political philosophy, as opposed to if you're a Democrat and you live in a Republican area, like Erie State or something of that nature, maybe you move to San Francisco, which is much more Democratic leaning. So I read an article that populations are doing that. So
when you were talking about parents homeschooling or going to private schools, I know that this particular administration is really geared towards charter schools, which is public schools, but being able to control the funding that goes towards charter schools. And even though you may think that it'd be more liberal in its application of subjects and so on and so forth, that perhaps that this is also another ploy of making suggestions, banding, censoring, or so on and so forth, even in the public sector.
Yeah. Governors control what goes on in their state. They have that type of authority. Unless they're violating something in the Constitution, they can control that stuff.
I interviewed two of our former teachers from Northumberland, Tom Dupree and Deatrice Callanan, and they both said that if they had the chance, they would teach CRT. And I really hate that the acronym CRT versus teaching history, teaching accurate history. I think that they politicize that to scare people, like they use the word socialism as it is a huge wedge with a nail in it, and we're going to wham your head in with it.
You know? Right. And I don't know who came up with the term critical race theory. I don't know if it progressives or if it was the GOP or whatever. But what they should probably be just using is teaching accurate history, as opposed to just focusing on the black race or the African-American race. Because that's basically what it is. It's just factual information. Well, it deals with race, obviously, because we were slaves and things of that nature for a number of centuries. But it does, when you say CRT, it does focus on just the fact that I want to talk about the black race, as opposed to just, I just want to talk factually about what happened in historically.
Yes, because you cannot exclude Native Americans You can't exclude the Chinese, the Japanese, all of the immigrants. You cannot exclude them in that. And this focusing on us will be, you know, wonderful in the scheme of things, but it's not, I think, is the right way to identify.
And even when you're talking about CRT, all of those particular races are included in it, because basically CRT just basically means that white Americans over the centuries have basically set up a system for controlling minorities. They pushed the Indians out of Florida, and they set up the judicial system basically such that, you know, if you're an African American, you're more likely to be subjected to the criminal justice system than you are white American. You're more likely to get the death penalty. You're more likely to get years in jail, et cetera. So, yeah. And it's just not just about black Americans. If you're Native Americans, you're more likely to be on the reservation and not have the resources to do what you need to do to survive. You pushed off into reservations, you violate, they just take your land. They did that to everybody. You remember that you've heard recently about the case in California where this black family learned and recently won a particular case such that a lot of beachfront property out in California belonged to them, and that's going to be given to them.
Yes.
So, you know, so that's people don't like that. People have been stealing land from minorities for centuries. Yeah. And you can just do what you want to do with them. I mean, you just think about it. If you looked at it back in the 40s and 50s down south, if you looked at a white woman or something of that nature, you could be killed.
You were
and nothing
killed.
And nothing would be done about it. Yeah. You had to look down at the sidewalk when you passed by.
Get on the other side of the sidewalk. You had to cross the road and walk on the other side of the sidewalk with your eyes still down.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you had, back in the 30s and 40s, the mass migration of African Americans that went from the south to the north, like places like Detroit, New York, Chicago. Yeah, because they couldn't survive down there. They didn't have any rights.
I want to ask, like, during your early years of employment, did that influence you when you thought about joining the Labor Department or working with the Labor Department?
Well, when I really started working officially was when I got out of college, obviously. So at that particular time, you know, I was 22 years old. And I went in the U.S. United States Army. I was the second lieutenant. At that time, I wanted to make the Army a career, but along the way, I started changing my mind about what I wanted to do. And then after I came back from Korea and I was stationed at Fort Bragg for 3 or 4 years, I decided that I wanted to go to law school. But in order to prepare for law school, I had a bachelor's in history. So I applied to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro for a master's degree in history. I got accepted there. It took me about 2 years to finish my master's degree, about a year and a half. While I was in graduate school, I applied for law school at North Carolina Central University School of Law. And luckily, I got accepted there. I transferred over to Durham, North Carolina, where the law school is located. And it was 1982, and I finished in 1985. Most of my family members are in the Washington, D.C. area, and I always wanted to come back to Washington, D.C. I missed a lot, and I missed my family. After law school, I came up to Washington, D.C., and one of my siblings had gone to college with the person who was the director of the Department of Public Works for the D.C. government. And she said, I'm going to call John Touchstone. And I remember John Touchstone when I was growing up, because he used to come down with my sister and brother-in-law, because all of them went to Virginia Union in Richmond. He called me up and said, Al, you got an interview for a position over here at Department of Public Works in Washington, D.C. Come talk to this particular person. So I did, and I got in D.C. government. I stayed there from January of 1986 to about 1988 or 87. Also, at that particular time, when you come out of the Army, at that particular time, you could go into the Army Reserves. So while I was in North Carolina, I was in the Army Reserves, and so therefore I was in both law school and graduate school to supplement my income and things of that nature. And at that time, I had the GI Bill. So they paid for my graduate school and law school. So when I got to D.C., I joined the D.C. National Guard, Army National Guard. And eventually I became a commander of one of the units over there, of one of the companies over there. And so I did that for about 2 or 3 years. And then finally, I took a full-time position for 1 year over at the D.C. National Guard. And I was a captain at that particular time. Stayed there for 1 year. I didn't like the political environment at the D.C. National Guard at that particular time. And so I decided to go back to the D.C. Department of Public Works. And they asked me to come back. They said, sure, we'll bring you in. And I was working for the same boss that I had before I left. And so I stayed there for about a year. And then I started applying for a job for jobs in the federal government, which was just down the street from where I worked at D.C. Public Works. And I got a job in the U.S. Department of Labor in 1991, in May of 1991, I think it was. And I came in as a GS-12. The next year I was promoted to GS-13. And then eventually I was promoted to GS-14. And then maybe a couple of years after that, I was promoted to GS-15. And then maybe a year or two after that, I think it was 2001, I applied for senior executive position at the Department of Labor, and I got the job. And so I've been on SES within the Department of Labor since 2001. So it's almost 20, 21, 22 years. And so I've been doing that. And I stayed in the same organization during time that I've been at U.S. Department of Labor. And eventually, and I've been through, I think, maybe five or six presidents. The first one was, who was it? It wasn't George. It was George H.W. Bush when I first got there at Department of Labor, I think it was. And so I stayed there the entire time. And eventually, the person that was my boss, he retired. He was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Operations. And so the Assistant Secretary, who was a political person at that particular time, he asked me to come up and take over that job. And I took that job over in 2018. And I've been there doing this particular job for, since 2018. So collectively, I have about in September, August of September, I'll have about 41 years of federal service. And so, I think this is probably going to be my last year at work. So I've had a fun time.
So it's fair to say that it wasn't so much, your childhood, picking tomatoes mm-hmm. at 30,
right.
25 cents. It really was a trajectory from being in the military that drove right. your career.
Yeah, it was. I know I remember when I was picking tomatoes for 25 cents a basket. When I was 13. I think my parents did that on purpose to make sure that I went to college, because out of the all the boys and girls that were in my family, my parents had five boys, four girls. None of the boys went to college, with the exception of me. All the girls went to college, so they wanted to make sure I went to college. So that motivated me as well. And of course, I went to Virginia State University, HBCU, and so and that motivated me. And I can remember when I was in law school, I was thinking, I really would like to make $50,000 a year. And nowadays, $50,000 is not that much money at all. It's not.
I would love to have made $50,000 a year. And, anybody who has some extra coins want to, throw them my way. I have a huge catcher's mitt. Yeah. None of that's dropping on the ground. None of it.
So I've enjoyed. I've been blessed. I really have. And so, you save your money, you invest in your 401k, and treat people right, and you'll prosper eventually.
Thank you, Al. Thank you very much.
Good talking to you, Pixie.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye.
Facing challenges and overcoming them. Remember, we are mighty and we are strong. That is how it is being black on the Northern Neck. This program is dedicated to the parents, siblings, teachers, past and present, who continue to guide our past to our future. The music by Robert A. Hall. Thank you for listening.